ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Für unseres Reiches Macht!
From Hitler's secret drug addiction to a wrong turn that started a world war, the past is littered with hidden stories of turning points that changed the world. I'm Mark Fennell, and it is my mission to find them and bring them to you each and every week. No One Saw It Coming is the podcast that will change how you think about history. Find it now on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Damien Carrick here. This is the Law Report on ABC Radio National. Following the Bondi terror attack that targeted Jewish Australians and killed 15 people, the federal government has passed two significant pieces of legislation that it says are aimed at preventing future attacks. One tightens Australia's gun control laws, which we'll talk about shortly. The other allows for the banning of organisations deemed by the government to engage in hate speech or hate crimes. The Albanese government initially sought to also create a criminal offence of racial vilification. This was abandoned when it became clear that neither the Coalition nor the Greens would support those laws through the Senate. But with the support from the Liberal Party, the government passed revised hate speech laws. University of Sydney Emeritus Professor Anne Toomey is an expert in constitutional law. She has concerns the changes could have unintended consequences. And welcome to the Law Report. Before we speak about the laws that have been passed, can we talk about the proposed racial vilification offence that was dropped? What's the difference between creating a racial vilification offence and banning an organisation for hate speech?
The racial vilification provision, which was one that was directed at promoting or inciting racial hatred, that was going to be a criminal offence. So an individual could be prosecuted and sent to prison for doing so. That's been dropped, although, as we'll come to later, many states do already have similar types of provisions on their books. So I wouldn't want people to think that if you behaved in that particular way that, you know, you got off scot-free, you may still be convicted of a state or territory offence. But the other provisions that the Commonwealth passed were doing something different, and that was banning organisations. So it wasn't about putting anyone in jail directly. It happens indirectly, however, if, for example, you continue to be a member of an organisation once that organisation has been banned, or you continue to direct its activities, or you recruit for it, or you resource it. But the actual banning of the organisation isn't of itself involving a criminal offence or sending anyone to jail. It's just saying that this organisation is banned and the consequences of that are that you can no longer be a member without committing a criminal offence, etc.
So what was passed was the Combating Anti-Semitism, Hate and Extremism, Criminal and Migration Laws Bill 2026. Who is this legislation aimed at? What kind of groups is this legislation aimed at?
It's groups that are regarded as having engaged in conduct that constitutes what's described as a hate crime. So hate crimes are broader than just speech. So a hate crime can be, for example, an act of violence against a person on the basis of their race or damage to their property. It also includes offences of displaying Nazi symbols or terrorist organisation symbols. So all of those things come within a hate crime. But also, and the controversial part of this was whether or not there should be an extra offence of promoting or inciting racial hatred, and that would give rise to a hate crime. And then, of course, once your organisation itself has engaged in the hate crime, that's a trigger, and you've still got to go through the rest of the process, but it's a trigger for being banned. Now, because the Commonwealth dropped the proposed offence at the national level of inciting racial hatred, we had assumed when this new revised bill came up that it would mean that these provisions about banning hate groups wouldn't be triggered by that kind of conduct. And so what then surprised people is that the Commonwealth put in another provision saying that a hate crime also included publicly inciting racial hatred, if that conduct would either A, constitute a different offence under a Commonwealth law. So say, for example, in inciting racial hatred, you did so by sending offensive communications by post. That's a different Commonwealth offence, and because your conduct falls within that Commonwealth offence, that's enough to satisfy an offence for the purposes of a hate crime. Or, and this is where it got interesting, they said that it would also be publicly inciting racial hatred would also be a hate crime for the purposes of this legislation if what you did would constitute a state or territory offence. And then they listed the particular state or territory offences that would trigger it. And it gets quite messy at that point because the state and territory offences have, you know, different terminology, different defences, and even different criteria for there to be an offence. So, for example, the Queensland, South Australia and the ACT provisions all say that it's only incitement to racial hatred if you have done an act that threatens physical harm, for example. Whereas in New South Wales, Victoria and Western Australia, there's no connection to some kind of a threat of harm. You can have inciting racial hatred without that. And in Tasmania or and the Northern Territory, no provisions were listed for them at all. So you end up in a rather messy circumstance where conduct that would be described as publicly inciting racial hatred would only be a trigger for banning an organisation if it occurred in a jurisdiction where it would satisfy one of those offences. So if it occurred in Tasmania or Northern Territory, no. If it occurs in Queensland, South Australia and the ACT, only if you're also threatening physical harm. So we get this differential across the country, which is at best quite messy and at worst a little concerning.
So the legislation, we're told, is aimed at neo-Nazi aligned National Socialist Network and the radical Islamist group Hizb ut-Tahrir, whose actions have so far fallen below the legal threshold of criminal conduct. What is the process under this new law for banning such a group?
Yeah, so this is something which is quite peculiar because the complaint by the government is that these people have been actually obeying the law, and because they've been staying within the law, and therefore we're putting up this process and this mechanism for banning them because we're trying to catch people who have obeyed the law by saying, well, here are new laws, and by the way, if what you did in the past was perfectly legal at that time, it can still be a trigger for being banned. And so, for example, the new provisions that deal with terrorist organisation symbols or Nazi symbols, which have only recently come into effect, if you were displaying those symbols, you know, 5 years ago or 10 years ago when it was perfectly legal to do so, that's still regarded as a hate crime for the purposes of this law. And it's quite explicit where it says that no crime need actually have been committed, no one needs to have been convicted, and the conduct can be a hate crime even though it happened in the past when it wasn't a crime. So in generality, that's actually, I think, quite disturbing that we are treating an organisation and banning it on the basis that it has committed hate crimes even though it wasn't a crime and it wasn't unlawful at the time that it happened.
So can you take me briefly through the process whereby an organisation could be banned under this?
Okay. So the first part of the process goes back to ASIO. And so the Director General of Security, who's the head of ASIO, needs to give advice to the relevant minister, who's the Minister for the Australian Federal Police. And that advice is that the Director General is satisfied that this particular group has engaged in activities that are likely to increase the risk of politically motivated violence or communal violence, and has either itself advocated for or engaged in such violence, or there is a risk that it might do so in the future. So that's the criteria that the Director General has to be satisfied of. And then once that advice goes to the minister can take into account other things, not just that advice, but that's a condition precedent for the minister acting. And then it's for the minister to advise the Governor General to make a regulation banning this particular group. And to do so, the minister also has to be satisfied of certain things. So the first is the minister must be satisfied on reasonable grounds. And so the reasonable grounds might help, you know, lead to an administrative law challenge. So it has to be satisfied on reasonable grounds that the group has engaged in conduct. And critically here, it's engaged in conduct constituting a hate crime. So as I said before, it doesn't actually have to have been a hate crime. It doesn't have to have been something that was unlawful at the time. It just means that the conduct, what the group has done, would now satisfy the terms of a hate crime in the legislation. So they have to have either engaged in a hate crime or, and there's a whole lot of other words there, so being preparing for or planning or assisting or even advocating engaging in such conduct. So there are degrees of separation that go on there. Now, if the minister is satisfied of that, the minister must also be satisfied on reasonable grounds that banning the group is reasonably necessary to protect the Australian community or part of the Australian community from social, economic, psychological and physical harm, which, of course, is a very, very vague description. And that got amended when the bill was changed to say that you can satisfy that concern about social, economic, psychological or physical harm on the basis that the continued presence in Australia of that group is regarded as constituting social and economic and psychological harm. So pretty much that particular condition is meaningless. But the other key thing is that this is a regulation. It's a disallowable instrument. So it goes to Parliament, gets tabled, and within a certain period of time, either House would be able to disallow it. There's also a requirement that the Attorney General give agreement to the ban before it goes ahead. So that's another condition. And you also have to arrange a briefing for the opposition leader before that happens as well. So they're all the various little steps along the way in the procedure.
In opposing the law, the argument of both the Greens and the Nationals was that this law could stifle free speech. In your view, could the law be used to ban an organisation that says, for instance, Israel is guilty of genocide or Israel is an apartheid state or Israel should not exist? These are some of the issues that were put to the Federal Attorney General in a recent interview. What's your view?
So I think it's hard to know, and it's the uncertainty which is the difficulty here, because the uncertainty is the thing that will potentially chill speech. So organisations that don't want to be banned will be then reluctant to say certain things. So the Attorney General's done two interviews in relation to this on the ABC. So the first one was on the ABC 730 program. There were aspects of what she said which seemed to accept that that kind of conduct would at least satisfy the first part of the trigger, so being satisfied that a hate crime has occurred. But she rightly said that there are all those other aspects of that procedural list that you had to go through. So you needed ASIO's satisfaction and you needed the agreement of the Attorney General and all of those sorts of things. But later, the following day, she did come out and make another statement in a radio interview in Sydney. And she said this, I've got the quote in front of me, so I get it right. She said, "Let me be very clear for your listeners, criticism of a foreign country or of that country's government is not sufficient to meet the thresholds for listing." So that seems to be an attempt to clear that up. So it arises at a number of points. It arises at the point of whether the minister is satisfied. It also arises because of, you know, what ASIO might advise, but it's also an issue from the point of view of a court as well. So when this bill was going through Parliament, some of the independents tried to put in clarification into the legislation to make this clear, and they referenced a federal court decision. So Wertheim and Haddad from 2025, and they said in that case it had been found that criticism of the practices, policies and acts of the State of Israel, the Israeli Defence Force or Zionism is not inherently criticism of Jewish people and is protected political speech, not hate speech. So they tried to get that in the bill. Both the coalition and the government voted that down, again, leaving open that concern that maybe this might be regarded as hate speech because it's not clarified in the legislation. But now we see the Attorney General suggesting that she wouldn't regard it as hate speech to engage in that kind of conduct. So ultimately, it'll depend on what ministers do as to whether anyone is, any group is banned on that basis. And if they are, presumably they challenge it before a court, and a court might take a different view. I think the real problem in all of this is just the uncertainty that is around, because it's not absolutely clear on the face of the legislation. We talk about racial hatred, but people have different views as to what the meaning of hatred is. Years and years ago, hatred would have been some kind of extreme feeling. But these days, you hear people talking about hatred when it really is disagreement or dislike or criticism. So the meaning of the term would eventually have to be interpreted by a court if it was challenged.
Well, indeed, Hizbut Tahir, one of the groups that the government plans to target with its legislation, has announced that it will challenge the legislation in the courts. On what basis might it do that?
Well, it would be difficult to do so. It might try to do so before any kind of finding had been made against it. But if it had become banned under a regulation, then there would be, you know, potential grounds for A, arguing that, you know, ministers couldn't have had the relevant level of satisfaction for particular reasons. So it might be an administrative law challenge, or there could be a constitutional law challenge to the relevant legislation. So they might be looking at things like the implied freedom of political communication, because anything that prevented people from communicating criticism of policies and actions of countries, even though they're, you know, outside Australia, would still potentially trigger the implied freedom of political communication. So there's a possible areas where they might bring a challenge. But this first question is going to be one of standing. If a decision has been made banning them, and that's been done by a regulation, they would clearly have standing to challenge. But if no action's been taken against them, might be more difficult. But having been named, for example, in the explanatory memorandum as a target of the legislation might be sufficient to give them some kind of standing if they did want to bring proceedings prior to any action being taken.
So in your view, in conclusion, there are many ambiguities and questions still to be answered.
Yeah, I think it's still unclear. And, you know, that lack of clarity does have a chilling effect on freedom of speech. And sometimes that's even deliberate. I mean, I think in recent years, we've seen developments where, on the one hand, impressions are given by politicians and the like that certain things have been banned, like, you know, banning of demonstrations or banning social media for under 16s, when the laws actually don't really actually do that. So the laws are often more limited in their terms in order to ensure that they're not knocked down by the High Court, that they do satisfy the constitutional requirements of implied freedom of political communication. But yet the impression is given to the public that certain things are not able to be said, and that in itself has an impact on freedom of political communication.
University of Sydney Emeritus Professor Anne Toomey, an expert in constitutional law. Thank you. Thank you for speaking to the Law Report.
You're welcome.
Damien Carrick with you. This is the Law Report on ABC Radio National. The federal government's other legislative response to the Bondi attack are new gun control measures. They're contained in the Combating Anti-Semitism, Hate and Extremism, Firearms and Custom Laws Bill 2026. They contain a range of measures, including tougher background checks, better information sharing between governments and security agencies, also funding for a national buyback scheme, also more powers to restrict access to or the importation of certain types of guns, and also restricting firearm licences to citizens. Hobart lawyer Roland Brown is the Vice President of Gun Control Australia. Roland has been involved in gun control debates since well before Australia's largest mass shooting, the 1996 Port Arthur massacre in Tasmania, in which 35 people were killed. Roland, in your view, would these measures potentially have prevented the Bondi terror attack?
Yes, they potentially would have.
Because one of the alleged Bondi gunmen, Sajid Akram, age 50 and now deceased, he owned 6 registered guns, and his son, Navid Akram, still alive, was at one point investigated by ASIO but this apparently was not known to New South Wales authorities who gave the licences to his father. So that situation would be addressed by these new laws?
It would be addressed by the new laws, because the system that the Commonwealth is expanding, which is their current self-check system that they have, is going to be enlarged to reach across their databases from ASIO through the criminal intelligence systems. And they're going to look not only at a person who's applying for a license, but their family, whether the family lives with them or not. And if that person has the effect of pinging the system, that will set off a red flag and we'll see a spanner thrown in the works for the applicant who wants the gun licence.
So the legislation allows ASIO and also the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission to provide intelligence of background checks to AusCheck, who are the sort of the gun licence people.
That's right.
The new laws also create a national buyback scheme. This legislation passed with support of the ALP and the Greens, but neither coalition party, neither the Liberals nor the Nationals. Which states and territories support this and which states do not, and on what basis?
Well, at the moment, all of the states and territories, apart from Tasmania, Queensland and the Northern Territory, are backing in these reforms. Although it's a bit of a moot point, because on the 18th of December last year, a small number of days after the Bondi event, all the states and territories backed in the federal government's plan at national cabinet level to investigate how they were going to restrict access to guns, how they were going to share intelligence, how they were going to introduce a national buyback on the basis of a 50-50 basis, and other sort of measures to control firearm numbers in the community. So they've all agreed to it, but now Tasmania and Queensland and Northern Territory are talking about backing out of the buyback process and wanting to stall the whole process.
Now, I guess there are a range of arguments for doing so, but one of the concerns raised, I think, by Tasmania and perhaps by the Northern Territory was the 50-50 split in costs of the buyback initiative. Do you think that the federal government should pay for the whole buyback? Would that be a way forward?
I think that this system requires each state to take responsibility for the protection of its citizens. And that includes police officers, and that involves buying back guns that are taken out of the general hands of the civilian community. That's their job, is public safety. Sure, the Commonwealth is part of that, but they're offering to contribute 50%.
The legislation also gives the federal government more powers to restrict the importation of certain types of firearms. What's been restricted?
Well, it's a power to restrict. There's no particular restriction that's been brought in. And it's very interesting because the minister in charge of the Customs Act and importation of firearms, keeping in mind only the Commonwealth has the power to regulate importation of firearms, the minister can apply either or both of a public interest test or a public safety test. So the minister can look at a gun that's set to be imported into Australia. It might be a pallet of them sitting on a wharf in Sydney, and the minister might say, no, we're not going to agree to that gun coming into Australia. It presents too much of a risk to the community.
And you welcome this?
Absolutely.
Do you think it goes far enough?
At this stage, absolutely, it does. And what we like about it is that the minister gets to decide on a case-by-case basis. Having said that, it will need some refinement. We would like to see that when the minister examines any firearms coming into Australia, they have to fit into one of the existing categories of firearms in the uniform scheme. And if it doesn't, the minister should reject it. But I anticipate that if a firearm is set to be imported into Australia and it doesn't fit into one of those categories, I'd be very surprised if the minister doesn't reject it.
Okay, under this legislation, you also need to be a citizen to have a gun licence. How significant is that shift?
Well, it's very significant in the context of a debate where there was a mass shooting perpetrated by a non-citizen. And there's some big issues that arise from that. From my point of view, as an advocate of public health model for gun control, it doesn't ultimately matter whether the person is a citizen or a non-citizen. The public health model of firearm control looks at restricting the availability of types of guns, of ensuring people have a genuine reason to have that gun and a fit and proper person to have it. Whether they're a citizen or not is neither here nor there. But having said that, we're not troubled with that kind of prohibition on a class of people having access to firearms.
Moving away from the legislation which has just gone through Parliament, Canberra also wants to press ahead with the National Firearms Register, I think first recommended after Port Arthur, but that won't be ready until 2027 at the earliest. Why is that register important?
I'll just say one thing about that register. It wasn't just recommended after the Port Arthur shootings in 1996. It was in fact agreed to by all the states and the territories. There was going to be registration of all guns in Australia and a national registration scheme. We got registration of all guns, but we've never got the national scheme. And even today, here we are in January 2026, states like Tasmania still have a paper-based system for registration of guns. So they have not put the resources into digitising the process of registration of guns. So that and the other states, some other states are in the same position, that is holding up the national scheme coming into effect. That was sped up after the shootings at Weambilla in Queensland in 2023. And we saw renewed commitments at a national level for that to happen, but it's been delayed, it seems, until 2027. But now we've had a commitment that they're going to speed it up yet again.
And the Weambilla shooting highlighted the lack of a national register, because I think a New South Wales gun licence was held by one of the shooters who was now then based in Queensland.
That's right. And it meant that the police had no knowledge of the type and number of weapons that these people held at this place in Queensland. And registration is really important for gun control because it backs in the efficacy of the licensing system, but it's also a very important tool to protect police and to solve crimes.
Roland, you know, big picture here, how are the powers to regulate firearms divided between the federal government and the states and territories?
Well, traditionally, firearms have been regulated at a state level, and that's been the way since Federation. The Commonwealth has some control over regulation of firearms because it's in charge of the import of firearms and ammunition into Australia. But I think that there are powers for the Commonwealth to regulate some aspects of firearms trading if they choose to exercise those powers.
Firearms trading, selling and buying of firearms. What Commonwealth heads of power would they use to do that?
They would use the corporation's power. And that power extends to regulating the activities of corporations. We saw in the High Court decision in 2006 that the High Court recognised that the corporation's power extended to regulating the activities of trade unions and frameworks for regulation of work rights in the workplace, and that was all through the prism of the corporation's power. So in my humble opinion, the Commonwealth, if it chooses to, would have that power.
Hobart lawyer Roland Brown, Vice President of Gun Control Australia. He's been involved in gun control debates since well before the 1996 Port Arthur massacre. Thank you. Thank you for speaking to The Law Report.
Thanks, Damien.
That's The Law Report for this week. Do follow the program on the ABC Listen app. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. A big thanks to producer Christina Kukolia and also to audio producer Kerry Dell. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.